Blog Talk Radio.
Well, thank you for tuning in again, and welcome to another episode of Can We Be Real? And we're very fortunate today. We have Dr. Barry Duncan on the line with us, and we're going to talk about how to be the change that you seek. Now, Dr. Duncan is taking time from his busy schedule. He is just a great guy. I tell you, he just is one of the best teachers that I ever sat in a class with, I'll tell you. He's a therapist, a clinical psychologist. He has over 17,000 hours of experience, international trainer, lecturer, noted researcher and author, and he's on the line. He's also the author of the book that is called What's Right for You? And that book has really been an integral part of changing lives and being a instrument in helping people to get over a number of health problems, including depression and the dysfunctional D's, and I'm sure he'll be able to tell us about those and also what he uses in order to help people. Because you're listening to Can We Be Real, and on this show, we find ways to help you. Dr. Duncan, thank you for being on the line, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here, Carl, and thank you for that kind introduction.
Oh, you're so welcome. You're really worthy of it, because I only met you one time, and during that class, I mean, the information was so enthralled, and I was enthralled by the information and found it so practical and bite-sized, because so many times in therapy, it's almost like trying to fix an elephant or eat an elephant, but you were able to break it up in bite-sized pieces, and I think that is so practical and useful in our day and age, especially when, you know, our lives are so stressful today.
Oh, that's so true, and I think that many approaches to therapy are trying to help people just way overcomplicate things in many respects, and they leave out the primary resource that's available for change, which is the person, him or herself. I mean, they already have all they need to overcome any adversity in their lives. You know, that's a God-given talent they already have if they only kind of can learn how to access those things that they already have.
Yes. In fact, I was listening to one of your interviews, and you stated that people can't get anything out of therapy that they don't bring to the table. Do you care to expand on that?
Sure. You know, there's a lot of beliefs within the field that people get something when they come to therapy that they don't already have, that, you know, because of their, you know, what I call these killer D's, disorders, deficits, dysfunctions, all these ways that we describe human beings, that because of those kind of frailties people have, that when they come to someone for change, that, you know, they have to be infused with things they don't already have. You know, I think that's a real wrong-headed way of thinking about things. It's not that people don't get stuck. It's not that people don't have troubles. It's not that life is not really difficult for a lot of people a lot of the time. So I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying, though, is that human beings have an incredible capacity and are amazingly resilient and can overcome adversity when they channel the strengths they already have toward their goals. So it's more of an issue of harvesting or enlisting what's already there to channel toward their goals, because when people look back at their experiences and they think of what they've already been through, you know, most of us are incredible survivors. We've been through a lot already. We've been able to transcend that. We learn from those experiences and we move on. But sometimes when we're in the throes of a very tough circumstance or a very bad time, we forget what we bring to the table. And that's where someone else, a friend, a colleague, you know, a pastor, a therapist, you know, can help you kind of channel what you already have to change what you're trying to change.
That is so true. And I've kind of followed up on those things in doing that as well, too, because in the work that I'm doing as far as coaching and helping people to grow and to recognize their innate and inborn talents, it seems sometimes that, you know, people do make mistakes, and then they kind of give good advice to other people, but they don't use it. And why do you think that, you know, we can see other folks' problems and fix them as opposed to applying the same medicine to our own lives?
It's a very difficult thing for human beings to do. To, you know, it's so much easier, and people are so much more compassionate to other people than they are themselves in many respects. You know, we'll blame ourselves, we'll say all these negative things about ourselves. You know, we'll even hate ourselves at times for the things we do, rather than, you know, stepping back and thinking things like, well, gosh, no wonder I was struggling at that point in time, given what was happening to me. We would say that to a friend or a colleague, but we have a hard time saying that to ourselves, and even more so then, we have a hard time then, you know, taking our own best advice that we would give our friends, because somehow we think that, you know, we're not worthy of being a devil that way, or it won't apply to us in a particular way. So I just think we wind up giving ourselves a lot harder time than we would other people that we're trying to be useful or helpful. We're a lot more compassionate to the frailties of other human beings oftentimes than we are to ourselves. And so, you know, that's one of the big messages I try to give folks in the book and, you know, as a therapist, is that, geez, you know, cut yourself a break here, you know.
Sure.
You don't walk on water. There's only one person perfect. And you know, that's kind of the nature of being a human being, is that, you know, we fall down.
Yes.
But we have an amazing propensity to stand back up, and that we also have to recognize that, you know, life can be very hard. It can throw some very difficult circumstances, and we aren't going to handle all those things in stride, and we are going to respond when bad things happen to us. We're going to respond with sadness and depression and anger as a normal human response to bad stuff, not saying anything negative about ourselves, rather than just saying, gosh, I'm human. You know, I make mistakes. I don't respond always the way I want to be. I don't treat my partner always the best way. My best self isn't always out there. But how can I make that happen more in my life, rather than, you know, thinking that there's something wrong with me as a person because I do step out of line from time to time?
Amazing. And where do you think we get these notions of and rigid demands of absolute perfectionism? And, you know, how do we apply that stuff to ourselves instead of accentuating the best parts of us?
Well, gosh, there's a media onslaught about that, Carl. I mean, you know, there are people that are invested in this, believing that we're sick somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, the drug companies, I mean, you can't turn on TV without seeing your drug company ad after ad after ad that kind of puts up, it shows you this person, for example, depression. They show this person, this usually a very young, attractive person, who's depressed and isn't responding to everything, and then they get the magic pill, and then all of a sudden they're happy and fulfilled again. But they give the idea that, you know, that problems in life are not normal. They give the idea that if you're suffering, you're having problems, or you're anxious, or you're depressed, you're sad, you're angry, that those things somehow aren't normal, and it means that some way you're broken, scarred, incomplete, or sick. I mean, if you read the latest thing, that you could look up, pick up any newspaper almost on any day, maybe it's not quite that, certainly almost any week, and you can see some mental health pundit talking about the sorry state of American mental health. You know, there are more disorders happening all the time. The new diagnostic manual will be out soon, and it's again increased the amount of disorders there are. Some people even say half of Americans have a mental disorder. I mean, you know, they've convinced us, and I really truly think that is the worst possible message to give people. They've convinced us that somehow we have wound up to be broken, scarred, incomplete, or sick. Not that we haven't had hard times, but they convince us that it's our fault, that there's something wrong with us. And the biggest problem for me about that is not that people see that they want to change something, it's that they believe that they have to somehow walk through this process, so that it's about them. It's about them being broken somehow is why they're experiencing problems, not that life in general sometimes can be very, very difficult. And we've all been through difficult times, but they generally don't characterize us as human beings. That's not how we think of our identity, but that's how the mental health industry, the pharmaceutical companies, that's how they would have us think about ourselves, that us at our worst time is characterizes our humanity. And that's the part that bugs me the most.
And from what I understand, instead of putting more money into actual development and research to figure out what motivates people and how to deal with grief and loss. They actually put more money into advertising like Zoloft on you know, the television and networks and so forth.
It is so true, and I hope that people can just wrap their head around this, Carl. The pharmaceutical companies spend more money on advertising than they do on research and development. They spend $10,000 per physician in the United States per year.
Wow.
They have a lobbyist for every member of Congress.
Gosh.
So, you know, when you think about that kind of power, you talk about, you know, that's an amazing amount of influence. It's way too much influence, in my opinion. Of course, I really, really distrust the political process when there's so much money put into shaping opinion that, you know, you wonder where the general individual is, and no wonder our opinions are shaped in particular directions about these things. But they spend an enormous amount of money. But they on psychotropic medications alone, drug companies made $40 billion, and that's a B, not an M, $40 billion on psychotropic medications alone. It's, you know, antidepressants sell more than, you know, hypertensive drugs. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think about that everybody, you know, one in four women in the United States is taking an SSRI.
Mm.
That to me is very, very troubling. Again, there's nothing wrong with a person wanting to try a medication. So if any of your listeners are taking medications, I mean that in no way a criticism of you. If that's what you feel will be helpful and it has helped you, that's great. But there are many people that antidepressants don't help, and it's been a marketing surge that's kind of made so many people believe that that's the only option for them when there are far less harmful options available to people. In fact, psychosocial options should definitely be tried first before medications.
And so you're saying there is a place for drugs, though, if there is some help that's being done.
Exactly. I mean, first of all, if it fits your preference, if you believe that, you know, your problem is biological in nature and medication will help you, then it makes some sense to give it a try. But, you know, so that's one issue, you know, and that, but on average, though, you know, it makes some sense to try psychosocial options first because, one, they're far less harmful. You know, and many medications don't really help that much. If a person is going to try a medication, they need to evaluate whether or not it's helpful or not. And, of course, that's where the, you know, the measures that I've co-developed come in, where you monitor whether you're progressing. But the problem is with medications, Carl, is that when the medication isn't helpful, they wind up adding another one to it or doubling the dose, and they just wind up doing more and more. Before you know it, many people wind up taking more than one drug. And when you get to that point, the drugs are very likely doing more harm than good when that stage happens, rather than saying, well, gosh, it doesn't look like medication is being useful for me. Maybe I need to think about some different ways of making changes in my life that have nothing to do with medication.
And before we get into some of the self-care and the psychosocial options, I just want to kind of touch on today now. I know when I was growing up, man, we were wild and running around and doing things, but now we see kids being labeled ADHD or ADD and giving them Ritalin and so forth like that. Is that part of the same kind of drug company overarching reach?
It is, but it's also combined, and the same thing, I was, you know, I was a wild and crazy kid, you know, and I know today that I would be diagnosed as ADHD, you know, and just on a personal note, my younger son, Matt, he's 21 now, but, you know, when he was in the third grade, I had teachers calling me and saying, you know, have you thought about medication for him? And I said, well, help me understand this. Is he a problem in the classroom? Well, not really. How is his grades doing? Well, he's a very good student, you know. Well, you know, I wasn't interested, you know, after that point. But, you know, it's, you know, for a, he was 8 years old at the time. He's a very active kid, really on the high activity level. I mean, he's the kind of kid that, you know, when he's sitting down, he's always thumping his fingers or bumping his knee. And, you know, he was really into sports. So the best thing that ever happened to him was he started playing hockey. And, you know, it burned up all of his energy. But
sure.
The culture is such that, gosh, you know, if a kid doesn't fit in perfectly, to the system, gosh, medicate them is the idea. So, and the drug companies have really kind of shoved that down our throat. But then you have the additional part is that parents feel under pressure so that their children perform as good as possible so that they have the opportunities available to them. So parents feel the pressure and, you know, teachers feel the pressure. And so it winds up, though, then played out in a child, which is really a travesty given that, you know, ADHD medications, they're stimulants basically, have really bad long-term results. They suppress growth. Kids lose growth and height and weight that they never regain. And you know that growth, general growth, is correlated with brain growth. You know, so it's really scary stuff to do, to think about kids being on these drugs. And in actual, the long-term results show that actually they're worse than nothing if you look at the long-term results. The largest study ever done is called the multimodal study of ADHD, and they followed kids for past 3 years and found that any of the gains that were initially happened by giving the kid the stimulant had long since gone, and while at the same time the kids had their growth suppressed in the process. So I can't think of an upside to that stuff except that, again, some people believe they've been helped, but the numbers are really not in favor of the drugs being all that effective. So I'm very disturbed about the trends of so many children taking these drugs. And now what they do, Carl, is if a kid has a behavior problem at all in a classroom, they want to put the kids on antipsychotics.
Oh, my
which
God.
You wouldn't believe it. It's the largest growth issue of sales among drug companies is giving kids antipsychotics. And
wow.
It's really behavior control. And if you happen to be a foster care kid, you know,
yeah.
you're 9 times more likely to be taken an antipsychotic if you're a ward of the state, and
wow.
if you're a minority kid, you're about 4 times more likely to be taken antipsychotic. So if you're different from your provider, you know, watch out. So you know, so that tells me it's more used as behavior control. It's not treatment. So I wish they'd just say that we want to control these kids because they're a problem. We don't want to deal with them. So we're going to give them this very, very major tranquilizer, and rather than, you know, trying to deal with the problems in the schools and the teaching and their family and all that kind of stuff. So it's a very disturbing trend. And I write about that, and I present about that, and I am doing all I can do to raise awareness about that. On my website, heartandsoulofchange.com, there's a whole section about psychotropics, if people are interested in that. There's a lot of information about psychotropic drugs on the website.
And so the website is heartandsoulofchange.com.
Correct.
Yes, great. And so we definitely would advise you to send there, because Dr. Duncan, I tell you, he shares information, gives us the real truth, and really, he doesn't charge a lot, I tell you, because all the information I got today, I didn't pay a dime.
Well, some people say I'm not very smart, Carl, but there are over 200 free downloads on my website, and, you know,
wow.
I just like for information to be accessible to people.
I think that's a godsend, really, because so many times now we're just, you know, monetarily driven, the profit motive, you know, and we won't get into that side of the conversation, but I think it does really drive the drug sales.
Oh, it does. The problem with the profit motive, Carl, I mean, you know, I'm for capitalism and all that stuff,
yes.
But the problem with big companies sometimes is they have no conscience. You know, to what they do. I mean, greed kind of is the trump card. Making money and profit is what they're about, and so they don't have a moral conscience a lot of times for what they do, because I think it's really unconscionable to give these drugs to children the way that they're being given, especially when the data doesn't support it. But they can overcome the data with all the marketing that they do and all these, I call them Stepford marketers, you know, these very attractive young people that go into these doctor's offices week after week after week giving samples, and they call it detailing, telling the doctors about the different drugs that are available. You know, they're just doing a constant sales pitch and leaving all these free samples and all these goodies. You know, I was in my doctor's office, I had my annual checkup, and I went in, and while I was in there, I saw a drug company rep came in, and the drug company rep brought in, you know, catered food for the staff.
Wow.
You know, I mean, I'm sure that was not cheap to bring in caterers for, you know, 20 employees.
Sure.
Several hundred dollars, very likely. It wasn't like for McDonald's, I guarantee you that.
Exactly.
And, so, I mean, they really pumped the money into this process, and it's really unfortunate that the profit motive, you know, kind of wins out in a lot of respects. So people just need to be aware there are many other options available rather than that. But again, I mean, if people, some people are helped by it, and, you know, I'm never going to rain on that parade if people feel like they've benefited from it.
Absolutely, absolutely. It reminds me of one of the scenes from The Matrix, and where the lady told Neo that they want to turn you into a copper top. They want everybody to conform and become like, you know, this battery that fits into this system within, you know, and if you get out of line any kind of way, being this, especially with the youth and the children, then we've got to find some way to make you control. And there's not a lot of teaching that goes on in those classrooms, but it's spent more time keeping people under almost a docile state. And I don't think that that's human, and it's definitely not good for the children.
Oh, definitely not. I really agree with that viewpoint. I hadn't really thought of it from a Matrix point of view, but that's so true. It's like you got to conform and fit in. If you don't quite, we'll make sure that you do. And, you know, if you're different at all, we're going to make sure that, you know, you stay quiet and out of our way. And it's a very sad commentary on, you know, the way the system operates for a lot of children. And, you know, and frankly, Carly, it's poor children.
Mm-hmm.
Is the ones that mainly get, because, you know, middle class families tend to, you know, kind of have more resources available to think about different options and to try different things. And, you know, poor kids and foster kids, they are the ones that really get nailed.
Yes. In fact, there's a video on YouTube, and if you Google it, there's a 5-year-old child being arrested and handcuffed in Florida. And that was a couple years back because supposedly they couldn't control her. They videotaped her and so forth. But when I was in school, you know, they made you sit down and shut up and be quiet.
And so they did. They sure did.
Yeah, they didn't play that. I mean, I remember at one point one of the nuns that, you know, I went to Catholic school for my primary years, and Sister Mary Frances, she kicked me in my rear. And it didn't bother me a bit. I wasn't broken. I went on to get a master's degree, okay? And so, you know, a good pop upside the head or the hand or the behind, you know, I mean, where do we get all this stuff from that we can't correct our children?
Yeah, you know, it's really a shame that you would think that a 5-year-old would,
yes.
You couldn't manage a 5-year-old. You know,
right.
It's sad commentary on the system, too, and gotten way, way strange about, you know, the methods used with kids. But you're right. I mean, in those days, there were, you know, control was kept to the children. But, you know, I've been in classrooms, you know, relatively recently, Carl, and with teachers that didn't have the problems maintaining a classroom. You know, teachers are like every other profession. You know, I always talk about how therapists are very different from one another. If you remember, you know, my talk about that it really depends on who the therapist you get, whether or not you benefit oftentimes. But, you know, it's the same way with teachers. You know, there are some teachers that are just so good. They manage their classroom well. They're really into what they do. And then there are teachers that aren't very good at it, that they're flustered. They can't handle when kids get out of hand a little bit. And, you know, they're the ones that push the panic button and start calling parents and saying, your child needs to be on ADHD drugs or whatever.
My God. And when really they probably just need somebody to sit down and talk to them and show them that they care. And believe it or not, we're getting down to like the last 6 minutes. And so I want to focus on some of the self-care stuff. What can people do as a possible first line of defense if they're feeling a little blue and sad?
Well, I think that the first thing that folks can do is to take that message that they're feeling down or sad as a message they need to do some personal reflection.
Okay.
That it's a message from themselves that there's something about their life that's not going well. And it's kind of our way of giving us, you know, a wake-up call. There's something about my life I need to examine right now. Is it my relationships? That's what it is a lot of time. My relationship with my partner, with my children, you know, with my work, with my life, with my friends. You know, where do I need to, you know, what is it about my life that this has given a message to me that, you know, as a wake-up call for me to look at what's happening? I'm like, how am I living my life right now? And what am I doing that's kind of creating a context for this message to come up? You know, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is to say, given what's happening to you, I mean, if you're going through a lot of stuff right now, given what's happening to you, no wonder this may be just the most realistic response to your life right now that is available to you. You know, I don't know what you're going through or what you're struggling with, but, you know, it could very well be that anybody on the planet would respond with sadness or feeling down or depression, given what you're experiencing, because that's how we respond.
Yes.
We respond to bad stuff by, you know, feeling down and kind of reorganizing and trying to think it through. So that would be another thing, just looking at your life. I mean, if you're in a bad relationship, or, you know, that's a common response, things aren't going well at work, just your life is kind of not going the way you'd like it to, you know, maybe you've lost your job or some other more serious event has happened to you. These are normal responses to those kinds of things. So, you know, one is to say, is this kind of a message that I need to do something different in my life and think about my life in a different way? And two, you know, it's probably a natural response to bad circumstances, and can I kind of look at my life in that context, knowing that, geez, you know, and can I say to myself, no wonder I'm feeling this way given what I'm going through. So those are two important aspects. But once you kind of identify what you think that could make it better, and the way to think about making it better is not like, how can everything be fixed? How can I go from 0 to 60 in, you know, in 40 seconds?
Right.
you want to think more, what can I do that will have some impact in the way that I feel? What can I do? What's that one thing that I can do? And then try to highlight what will make a difference in your life, and hopefully enlist the help of, you know, someone that you trust. I mean, and by mean help, I mean, you know, talking about it, reflecting about it, getting their viewpoints about it, and starting to kind of approach it like you would every other thing that you're trying to get done in your life. You're reflecting about it, you're soul-searching about it, you're talking to people that you trust about it and getting their views, and seeing what comes up about what you think may be a good direction.
And just for about the last minute, your final thoughts, and also, how does nutrition and exercise play into those?
I tell you what, Carl, nutrition and exercise are the greatest first-line defense against any emotional or mental health issue that comes up, because when we shut those things down and don't take care of them, then what we're doing is not making ourselves as emotionally resilient as we could be. So, you know, a good diet and exercise is very, very important to emotional stability. So it's a good first line defense, and it's just about good. I mean, it you know, I don't know if your listeners have know about the not much research here in the U.S. because of the drug companies, but in the U.K. there's research that, you know, people who exercise regularly or put on exercise regimens for depression rather than antidepressants get better results than antidepressants do. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense to have those things as an important part of your routine.
Well, I sure appreciate it. The 30 minutes is about gone. You got like 60 seconds left. And I thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to share with us how we can be the change that we seek, and some of the ideas on personal reflection and looking at our relationships, being around people who care about us, good nutrition, exercise. I'm sure these will all prove valuable. And your website is heartandsoulofchange.com. Dr. Barry Duncan, you rock.
Thanks very much, Carl. Appreciate being here.
Yes, we appreciate you. And thank you for sharing. God bless you. God protect you and God keep you. Just know that you're listening to Can We Be Real? And we're here quite a bit. I'm Help Somebody, and that's all I live to do is help somebody. So make sure that you enjoy your life. Be the change that you seek in the world. If you need some help, seek some help. Have some fun. Enjoy your life. Just know that you don't have to take it so seriously. There's no such thing as a perfect person. Perfect and people just do not go together. Be easy on yourself. Be a little more realistic. Deal with it. Some things you can change, other things you can't change. We appreciate you listening, and thank you very much for tuning in to Can We Be Real? Talk to you again.